We would like to call the post-council meeting June 2nd, 2016 to order. It appears that we have a quorum. As in the matter of those excused today, we'd like to excuse Commissioner Kerry Gibson and also Sheriff Tracy today. He's out with a medical issue. We would like to turn the time over to Director Stevenson. He has a new introduction of post staff.
Very good. Thank you. Jeremy Barnes, if you could stand. This is our new investigator. Comes to us from Draper Police Department. And we're excited to have him on board. And he's already done some good things in the investigative unit. That's who you'll be interacting with and the various administrators across the state. So right now we have 5 investigators to help deal with the backlog that we have experienced.
Welcome, Jeremy.
And we'll now move into our quarterly reports with Lieutenant Alacosta and Lieutenant Wade Brewer. Oh, minutes, yeah. Can we have you had an opportunity to view the minutes? Do we have a motion to approve?
Second.
Motion and a second. Spencer Austin and approved and made the motion, and Chief Stratton made the second.
Go ahead and have Lieutenant Alacosta. Motion. What do we need to do here at this point?
Just vote.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? So moved. We'll go ahead and now move forward with Lieutenant Acosta and Lieutenant Brewer. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is the quarterly report for post-investigations. This is reporting period from March 18th to yesterday, June 1st, 2016. We have received 30 complaints in this quarter, opened up 14 investigations, have not conducted any administrative hearings. We have closed 7 cases with no action. We have 6 voluntary relinquishments, and those were for custodial sexual misconduct, sex on duty, falsification of government records, criminal mischief, disorderly conduct, DUI, possession of controlled substance, domestic violence in the presence of a child. We have reviewed 228 applications for to attend the peace officer training, 26 waivers, 41 dispatcher applications, for a total of 295 applications for this quarter. We currently have 101 open investigations, and active we have 91. Any questions? All righty, thank you very much.
Council members, ladies and gentlemen, it's good to be with you this morning. So for the training quarterly report, the reporting period that we are going to be reporting on, just for ease of numbers, is March 1st of this year to May 31st, just so we are consistent in the future. We're going to just take a 3-month block of reporting. So we started for the basic training. There are currently 2 classes in session. Class 318 graduated on April 21st, which was this quarter, in the LEO block. They started with 33 cadets, and we certified 31 law enforcement officers. 1 officer was dismissed for policy violations during the academy, and 1 sustained an injury. The one who sustained an injury is going to be able to return. I think he'll be able to return in this class starting on Monday in the LEO block, so it'll be 5 weeks later from this Monday. Class 319, which is currently in session, is in the LEO block. They started with 25 cadets, and that one graduated on May 12th. Started with 25 cadets, certified 23 officers. Once again, we had 1 medical injury And that one is going to be able to be rolled forward as well. And I don't actually have the other reason for what that dismissal was for on the other cadet. And then class 320 is currently in the law enforcement block, started last week. They started with 14 officers, and they still have 14. They're scheduled to graduate next week, which will be June 9th. Any questions on our current law enforcement training? Okay, so I'm reporting on in-service training. During this reporting period, we trained 877 officers and dispatchers for a total of 812 hours of training. And we administered 42 in-service training classes. And that spans the course of basic dispatch, defensive tactics instructor, and et cetera, on down the line. Any questions regarding the in-service training report? Anything that you're hearing that we need to be adding from your agencies? Okay. Thank you. Chair, would you like me to move to the next?
Yes, if you can move to post-curriculum update, that'd be great.
Okay. Satellite Academy audits. There were two Satellite Academy audits performed this quarter. The first one was Weber State University. The director there is Director Jack Rickards, and met with him on June 26th and his staff, and we went over the administrative audit. There are no exceptions to report with this audit. Just as a side note, we did work I'm working with Director Rickards with one of his new hires and an agency that needs EVO training, and we're working through that to make sure we get that individual trained that's been hired out of his academy. Just as a side note, since our numbers have been up so much, the EVO courses that normally we roll these Satellite Academy cadets into have been full, so we're just looking for creative ways to make sure that we get these individuals trained and back to their agencies like we promised the administrators throughout the state within that month that they're hired. So that was one issue that we worked through with Weber State University. The next audit that was performed was the Bridgerland Applied Technology, and the director up there is Rod Peterson. They currently have one class in session, and there are no exceptions to report with his audit. So any questions regarding the satellite audits or the process that we go through during these audits? Okay. Chair.
We'll now move forward to the post-curriculum update. Lieutenant Brewer, if you can take that.
Okay, so I'm going to be reporting on the special function officer block and the law enforcement officer block training curriculum updates, and then after I'm done, I'm going to turn the time over to Director Kirk Christensen from the Corrections Academy, Utah Department of Corrections, to report on and ask for the changes for the basic correctional officer block. So that's how this one's going to go, this segment. So for the special function officer block, I'll just refer you to the handouts. Most of you are looking at them that are right after the minutes. The special function officer block, you'll notice that we are not recommending any changes for 2016 to 2017. And just as a side note, I've been meeting with an executive group that we created that's looking at training for sexual assault and domestic violence. And Donna Kelly from the Utah Prosecution Council, Major Brian Redd with the State Bureau of Investigations, and Ned Searle with also the Prosecution Council makes up that executive committee. And we've identified some areas that we believe in the curriculum that we need to bolster. And one of those areas has to do with trauma-informed interviewing. And so we feel like that, even though we haven't made recommendations to the special functions officer block, that there's possibly some curriculum that we need to update in either the victimology, or I was talking with one of the council members this morning that might fit in another law portion block. And so we are looking at seeing if we need to add a couple of hours there and what will that look like. We are doing a review as we are re-recording the special functions officer block. And so as we're doing that recording, we're also able to review these courses to see if the time that's allotted to each course is really what we need. And so even though we haven't recommended changes, there might be something that we bring before the post council in the fall to see if we can't make those adjustments and update a little bit of that curriculum. So any questions as you look over? Yes, Director.
Lieutenant, have we, you have any early indications on how the mental health classes are going, the response to mental health and all that we updated last year or whatever?
Yes, so since we have been teaching, so this is the second full year of curriculum that we've done those. Some of the feedback that I've getting back that, if you'll remember, that the council made a recommendation that only CIT trained officers teach that mental health portion of that block. The only feedback I'm getting is that it is sometimes difficult to have a CIT trained officer deliver that curriculum. Now, the satellites have been doing that, but sometimes it has been a challenge, and we have noticed that even with our scheduling as well. So, I mean, that's the feedback we've been getting. The curriculum sounds like it's pretty good. It's solid. I don't know if you've been staying abreast of any of the changes with the CIT programs. There is a little bit of a shift going on right now, and we're staying close to that. But it doesn't sound like the philosophy is changing at all. It's just really who's going to be administering that CIT for the Division of Alcohol, or excuse me, Division of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, who administers that grant for the CIT program. Welcome. Anything else regarding that and the mental health training? Okay, so refer you to the next page, which is the law enforcement officer block. If you'll notice that, once again, the only change that we're recommending there this stemmed from our interaction with the sexual assault curriculum updates that we're doing along with the domestic violence. And we felt like that the domestic violence cohabitative abuse procedures, that class needs to be bolstered by 1 hour to allow us to then teach in the curriculum this lethality assessment procedure and protocol. So some of your agencies might already be doing this, but there's a pilot program going on with four different areas of the state right now where there's a lethality assessment that is done during a domestic violence call. And this lethality assessment gives the officer an opportunity to then give the individual, the victim, the assistance right there on the phone if they're at high risk for lethality. So we felt like, well, if this isn't important enough that they're already doing this through many agencies in the state, well, then our basically trained officers need to know about this assessment. So those objectives have already been run past Donna Kelly through the Attorney General. Excuse me, she's actually the Prosecutor Counsel training group underneath the Attorney General's office, but I don't know how that actually works. She gets paid by the Attorney General's office, but she is underneath the Prosecution Counsel. Anyways, she's the one that has delivered that lethality assessment training a couple of times already in our academy as a pilot program. It's received very well. So the objectives include what the lethality assessment is and how it is supposed to be delivered in the field for officers, because the line officers are the ones who are going to be doing this. So it's important enough that they understand that. And anything that we can do to help victims out, get out of that relationship, we feel like we definitely need to adopt that to the curriculum. So that's the recommendation that we are going to be asking for during the LEO block. So any questions regarding that discussion?
We have a motion to accept.
Mr. Chair, I move we accept those.
And a second.
I'll second it.
Motion by Toby and a second by John.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, Lieutenant Brewer.
Okay, thank you.
Now I'll turn the time over to Director Stevenson for post-screening and invest.
One. Director Christensen needs to cover the basic correctional officer block.
Okay. We'll turn the time over to Director Christensen.
Good morning, Post Council. I'm Kirk Christensen, Training Director for the Utah Department of Corrections.
The Utah Department of Corrections coordinates the basic correctional officer block four post, and we're recommending just a couple changes this year within that block. The first change that we're recommending is adding a course. The course will be titled Professional and Effective Communication with LGBTI Offenders. Utah Department of Corrections, like many other correctional facilities, is seeing an increase in our LGBTI offenders that are incarcerated with us. Last month, National Institute of Corrections provided technical assistance to Department of Corrections on this subject, and what we're proposing is pretty much a mirror image or a continuation of that training that they provided for us. The course of instruction will cover common terms, current law regarding LGBTI offenders, and effective communication with offenders. What it will not cover is agency policy. We're not going to talk about it in the course because agency policy is going to be different for every agency. And our attempt is not to change anyone's belief regarding our LGBTI offenders, but more to suspend their beliefs or their judgments to be able to talk effectively with these offenders. We've piloted this training for the last two sessions, two BCO sessions, within the Corrections Training Academy, and what we found is that 2 hours is adequate to cover the topics that we are planning on covering. Also, adding this course will show compliance to Section 115.31 of the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which specifies training must be conducted, including how to communicate effectively and professionally with inmates, including lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, and gender nonconforming inmates. Even though we currently do teach PREA within our curriculum, we do not necessarily discuss those items specifically. In our piloting of this course, I just mentioned that 2 hours was adequate to teach the course, address any concerns, and answer any questions. We did present this at our curriculum meeting about 2 months ago. That curriculum meeting includes many of our jail commanders and also our satellite academies, and they all felt that this belonged in the basic correctional officer block. So that's our first change. Any questions regarding that? Okay. The second change that we're going to be requesting is just a change in hours on our gender responsive class. Our subject matter experts have come to us. They've just talked that the 4 hours is too long. The classes tend to get out quite a bit early, and they're using a lot of filler information to cover the objectives. We also brought that up at our curriculum meeting, and the other subject matter experts that were there agreed with that, reducing that class from 4 hours to 2 hours. And what that allow us to do is continue to have 172 hours in that block without increasing any time. It also brings that in line with the course that we're proposing, and also with our we have a class that focuses on generational perspective. So our LGBTI class, our gender-responsive class, and our generational perspective class will all be 2 hours, so they'll be a little bit more uniform in that. So those are my recommendations.
Any discussion? Motion to approve. Have a second? Motion to approve by Sheriff Decker. Was that correct? Oh, sorry. And the second was Bruce Bailey. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? With that, we'll move forward to post-screening and investigative process by Director Scott Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair. As usual, it's always a pleasure to stand before this group. In light of some of the questions that have been asked the post staff, and also with addition of new council members, we felt compelled to just inform you about the investigative process and what lengths we go to formulate a recommendation and what goes into it before it is presented to you. So just no different than any other case, it starts out with a complaint. Those complaints can come from anonymous citizens, officers, administrators, even media can, we have received complaints in the past. So we look at those complaints and we automatically, input them into the complaint log. So every complaint goes into a complaint log. And at that point, senior staff decides whether a case should be opened or not. At this point, we don't look at the likelihood of meeting the burden, but if, based upon the information that we have, was there a violation of federal or state law, or a violation of Garrity, or sexual misconduct on duty. If we decide not to open a case, and if we open a case, we make the notification to the administrator and the officer. Now, if we don't open a case, then as a courtesy to the administrator, we will let them know that a complaint has been generated from their area, to let them know that, you know, this may be a policy violation, but not necessarily a state or federal violation. Once a case is started, there is ongoing review. It's not just, you know, we give it to the investigator and they are sent out to find the facts. They're under constant scrutiny and review. Specifically, there's a monthly review with each individual investigator to make sure that the case is on track to be completed and that we're making the necessary interviews to make sure that everything is moving forward. Also, the senior staff is, you know, involved at every step of the way. There may be a unique circumstance, and they may need some guidance on to which angle of approach or who to interview or what violation we should look at, maybe not necessarily agreeable to the original complaint. Once everybody's been interviewed and the investigator feels like they have found all the facts, then they will write an investigator report and send it to the lieutenant for review. Lieutenant reviews it to make sure that all the, you know, the elements are met and that it is professional and that no stone has been left unturned, even though, as you know, there's always a stone that we could turn. Once it's been reviewed by the captain or the lieutenant, then it goes up to the captain for the same type of scrutiny. And once that's passed his, you know, approval, then the notice of agency action is drafted. And that is kind of an uncomfortable situation for the investigators because once they draft the notice, it's put up on the screen for senior staff and the investigators to scrutinize and pick apart to see if it meets the state statute, our statute, and to see what sanctions should be used in this notice. Now, again, there may be a violation that we did not include in the notice. And there are several reasons, but one specifically that we've come across from time to time is not having the victim relive the situation. So if we have a violation that is very obvious and we feel like, you know, we don't need the additional charge, then we won't have the victim go through that experience again. So you may be wondering, okay, why didn't we look at this? Most times we have. We just decided it was not advantageous, considering our resources and time, to move forward on that specific violation. When we're reviewing the notice, if there is not consensus in a direction, then it will be screened by the attorney for guidance. And really, that can occur at any stage of this investigative process. And so the picture I'm trying to paint is that at any moment it can be reviewed and is oftentimes reviewed and scrutinized. When we come up with a sanction at the point of reviewing the notice, when we consider the violations, we look at the guidelines heavily, and we also consider contemporary decisions the council has made. So an example, last March, we had two cases with the same violation. And one we felt like was more egregious than the other, but the council decided to go with a higher sanction on the less egregious violation that we viewed. And so that decision is going to affect future decisions based upon the council's contemporary vote to increase that sanction. So what I would like you to consider when you vote, keep that in mind, that the decisions that are made today are going to affect cases tomorrow. Once a notice is signed and approved and has gone through Marcus and me for final approval, it'll go out via certified mail or hand-delivered. Either the officer under scrutiny comes to the office or we go out and seek them and deliver it by hand if we cannot reach them via certified mail. Once the notice has been sent, there's 30 days for them to respond to that notice. If we have not received any word or response from the officer, then we move for an order of default, and that consists of meeting with an ALJ and presenting the facts that we have found. And the ALJ will decide whether we met our burden of proof or not, and the order of default is issued and then presented to the council. If we receive a waiver, which, mind you, when they sign that waiver, they are stipulating to the facts of the case. This is all part of their due process rights. Once we receive that waiver, then it is presented to the council. If they exercise their right to a hearing, then Julie is tasked with the sometimes impossible task of making all these schedules work together so we can meet on one day and present the case to an ALJ. So it takes a lot of coordination on her part to get all these people together for this hearing. But we try to do it within 30 days of receiving the waiver or the request for hearing. And then as a council, we present it to the council, and the council makes the decision. And after the council has made a decision, a final order is issued. The chair signs the final order, and it makes the officer aware of their appeal rights. They appeal directly to the Utah Appellate Court, and that is just scrutinized for process. Am I correct in that? Okay. I want to get to the guidelines. A lot of times the council is asked, okay, how'd you come to this sanction? And I touched on it a little bit earlier in my presentation, but I want to go into more depth about the guidelines. In 2005, we had a lot of changes to the statute, and so we felt compelled to create a document that would establish a little more consistency. Right now, the ratification rate is between 80 and 90% consistently since the guidelines have been implemented. Prior to that, we were in the 70 percentile. So there has been consistency. When you look at the guidelines, we have the baseline. That was historically researched based upon past decisions the council made for years prior to that. So that baseline is the consistent average that the council would make on a Class B misdemeanor or a Class A misdemeanor. The range try to capture the outliers. And so that's how we designed that document. That document was ratified and accepted by the council in 2010 and has since been modified and approved by the council two times since 2010. Some of you may be frustrated because you feel like we should be presenting more information. But at this point of the day, all the effort, all the paperwork that has been signed, the officer has exercised their due process rights. We cannot present additional information outside of the notice that has been given to you. That is a violation of their due process rights to be able to answer to those that information. Now, at times an officer will come before the council and infuse additional information. That's not the design of this meeting, is to have them argue the facts when they've already stipulated to those facts when they sign a waiver or has been presented in a hearing. This is a sentencing body to either accept the recommendation or not. An officer being presented to the council is just merely to say, okay, I think there are some mitigating circumstances in my life. Here's what was going on. And, request that either the sanction be reduced or no sanction at all. And that is completely up to you. And again, those guidelines you own. That is your document. And you can go outside those guidelines if you desire. But I will never do that. I will never go outside those guidelines. I will stay by the baseline unless there is something so compelling to deviate from that baseline. And you'll see a few cases today where that was the circumstance. If someone pleads guilty, now there are some cases that we look at and we do not feel like there is a violation of state or federal law, but the officer pled guilty for whatever reason, I'm compelled to present that to the council. Period. If I didn't, then I think I would be in violation of the process and not respecting it. And so you may see some cases where you're thinking, geez, we don't feel like there was a violation of state or federal law, and we're probably in agreement. But because they pled guilty, we are compelled to present that to the council for their vote. That concludes my presentation. Is there are there any questions? Anything?
Go ahead,
Mr. Director. How many of these decisions have gone to the have been appealed?
I don't know an exact number, but I can tell you specifically three that I know for sure, 3 to 5 since I've been director.
And that's been how long, sir?
Almost 9 years.
Director, I represent the Utah Sheriff's Association today, and I appreciate you bringing this up. The last two meetings that we've had, and when I say we, the Utah Sheriffs, there's been a concern about the investigation process. I'm the messenger today, so I'm bringing this information to you. There are sheriffs that are concerned that Post is becoming too much of a government entity as far as running their own individual offices. The sheriff and the chiefs are elected officials and appointed officials, and there's many offenses that you brought up today that I believe, and I know other elected officials and sheriffs and chiefs, believe should be handled within their own agency and their own department. Again, I'm the messenger here. I'm telling you what's been told to me. Sometimes these complaints that you brought about, you realize that those complaints, just the mere fact that an officer is having a complaint made against him, makes a real challenge for him, especially if they're not in or if they're not guilty of the offense. But just the mere fact that those have been made against him makes it very difficult sometimes for them to do their job and to continue on. So I guess some of the concerns are is when those complaints are made, who makes the ultimate decision as to whether or not, number one, it should be investigated, and where do you go with that information, and who do you contact about that?
Once we receive the complaint, it's screened by senior staff, so that consists of Captain Sparks, myself, and Lieutenant Acosta, to decide whether the information that we've been provided needs further follow-up for additional information to decide whether to open a case, and really to determine whether there's been a violation of the statute, state or federal law, sexual misconduct on duty, or a line under Garrity. Once we decide to open a case, then we move forward. And we make the proper notifications, one to the administrator and to the officer, to let them know that there is a post-investigation open. If we do not make or open the case, then usually it's me or Lieutenant Acosta that will contact the administrator and say, we've received this complaint on this officer, but with the information we have, we don't see a violation here, but it may be a policy violation by the department. So that's how it's scrutinized when it comes into the office.
Thank you.
If I could make a point, throughout this process, I encourage the investigators to try to make as much contact with the administrators as feasibly possible. When it comes down to us contacting an administrator and saying, okay, here is the recommendation, here are the charges, that is just to let you know what's going to be presented to the council. It is not to receive influence on what the sanction should be, because I stay true to the guidelines. And I think there may be a misconception with a few administrators that what they tell us influences the decision. That is just merely to give you a voice by our own statute so that you can submit a letter either on behalf against Post or on behalf of the officer. But it's just to provide you that opportunity to have your voice heard before this body.
Can I just add a comment, Director?
Please.
Just kind of dealing with these guidelines and, you know, the sanctioning of peace officers and certified dispatchers as council does. One thing to just keep in mind is these proceedings under the Administrative Procedures Act is considered what they call a formal action. And that's significant because if an officer or a dispatcher does appeal this council's decision, it goes to the Court of Appeals, and that Court of Appeals will look at the record from post-council and post. And I bring that up because since we're essentially the court of record that the Court of Appeals is going to be reviewing, it's a really good idea as this council deliberates to put the reasons why you feel about a particular sanction, especially if you are going to be on the edge of the guidelines or if you really feel strongly about exceeding the guidelines. It'd be really helpful to put that in the record, why you think that way, because that may be reviewed by the Court of Appeals, and it's just good to have a good solid record why the council felt it voted this certain way or sanctioned a certain way. So just keep that in mind.
Very good. Thank you.
Director, could you please describe, and I know it could be different for every case, but how the timeline for the post investigation would overlap with, say, an agency's IA investigation and with an outside agency pursuing any potential criminal charges?
Very good. Thank you.
Per our administrative rule, if we come across additional violations of law, we're required to report that to the jurisdiction. So I'm going to get that off the table right now. We do independent investigations that could parallel a criminal investigation. But if we view this set of circumstances as potentially putting us in a direct interference with a criminal investigation, we hold off and wait for the criminal adjudicative process to unfold. IAs, for example, there may be parallel investigations, but for the most part, we would like the IA to be completed because they also do a lot of the legwork and providing us witnesses for us to not be able to or not have to go seek out. But we will if we have to. So I don't know if that answers your question completely, but...
Well, I think that it sounds to me, and as I've seen and been involved in any of these investigations, generally you let the entity that is investigating and possibly pursuing criminal charges take the lead.
Yes.
And from what I have viewed with most agencies, they will typically hold off on their IA as to, again, not interfere with that process. So it sounds like, and this could be different again, that first the criminal investigation will take place, which will typically always happen with an outside agency. Then the agency's internal investigation will take place, which will happen within. And then you get the IA investigation, and then the criminal part decision has already been made about filing or not filing charges. So essentially those two components are wrapped up before you guys start actually...
Typically. But by statute, we do not have to wait for criminal adjudication or the IA to be completed. So if it's advantageous to avoid conflict, then we will hold on. We'll hold back our investigation. There are some cases that are just very clear-cut, and those ones we will move forward on. But if there is some challenges in moving forward, then POST will not move forward until everything else is completed.
And that's a case-by-case determination?
Case-by-case determination, yes.
Okay.
Good question.
Any further discussion? With that, we'll go ahead and move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. With opening remarks by Kevin Bolander, he's going to talk about annual training for open meetings.
All right, good morning, council members. For this meeting, we are going to do our annual training in the Open and Public Meetings Act. This is required by law that the chair of every council committee or board in the state do do training. The way we do that DPS is the AG's office provides that training for all the councils and boards in the in DPS. So my goal with this training is not necessarily to make you all experts about open, you know, public meetings, but I do want to highlight kind of the some important issues, just things just kind of keep in mind, so that way we make the right decisions as we deliberate and vote on matters. Because agencies that kind of run afoul of the Open Public Meeting Acts, or at least has the perception of doing so, I mean, you can just read the, you know, watch the news or read the papers. It's not pretty, and so we want to stay away from that, make sure we're complying with the law. And the point of it is, and the whole point of the Open Public Meetings Act is that state agencies conduct their business openly so the public knows what's going on and can see how agencies deliberate and come to their decisions on public matters. So, I mean, pretty clear cut. And so by that, these meetings are open to the public to come watch and observe and even comment. There are very few times that the meetings are closed. We'll get into those today, or at least get in the ones that are relevant to this council. So just a few kind of definitions here. The way the Open Public Meeting Act, what it includes is a term that it uses, public body. So a public body is any state administrative, advisory, executive, or legislative body of the state which has these things. It's either created by the Constitution, statute, or rule, consists of two or more persons, spends, distributes, or is supported by tax money, and has authority to make decisions about the public's business. So guess what? That is this council here. You are a public body. One other definition I want to talk about. This is what a meeting actually means. So basically, it's a convening of a public body with a quorum, so a majority, either in person or through electronic means to discuss or act upon a matter under its authority. What it does not include are chance or social gatherings. So let's say 11 of you decide after this meeting to go out to lunch somewhere. That's not a meeting. But let's say the majority of you decide to go out to lunch and you start discussing matters on an upcoming agenda, then you've just had yourself a meeting. So with that in mind, the way I do this training, I kind of divide it up into three parts, and some of you that have been on this council for a while have heard this several times before. But the first part is basically things that need to happen before the meeting. The second part are issues that come up during the meeting, and the third part is kind of the issues that are things that need to happen after the meeting. So before the meeting, the really big one here is notice of the meeting. And this is more kind of directed towards the post staff who posts the notice. But that's kind of intuitive because the public can attend. It doesn't really help to have a meeting if the public doesn't know about the meeting. And so the big thing with notice is a minimum 24 hours notice prior to a meeting. And the notice must be specific enough to notify about the public about the topics to be considered. So essentially, and it obviously includes obvious things like, you know, the agenda, date, time, place of the meeting. So that way the public knows where it is and what's going to be discussed. The way notice is done, two things. The most important is we post, I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a Utah Public Notice website. Posting notice there. The second thing is posting a copy of the agenda at the place where the public body either meets or is centered. And so I don't know if we're doing that, but it might be a good idea just to post a copy of the agenda on the doors just so we can see that. This is the important thing about notice. Or having items on the agenda. If something is not on the agenda, then this council cannot take action on it. So that's kind of the importance of having an agenda and giving adequate notice. However, the chair may allow members of the public to comment or bring up issues, and the council is certainly free to discuss those issues, but they just can't take any action until it's been properly noticed. One exception to the notice requirements is an emergency meeting. Emergency meetings are held by majority vote of the council, and to discuss a matter of an emergency or urgent nature. Basically, something that can't wait till the next council meeting, and that's important enough that the council can't give the normal 24 hours notice. That there's something that the council has to act on immediately. Those are pretty rare. I mean, I've been advising this council for about 4 years. I think we've done it maybe once. And that was because, I mean, the problem with this council is it only meets 4 times a year. And so there's kind of a long period between meetings. And there was an issue that we had to kind of, if you remember, it was about a year or two ago, there was an issue where we had to have an emergency meeting to deal with someone who was sanctioned, but it turned out they didn't get notice. So we had to kind of go back and set aside the suspension until we could properly notice and hear it. So, but like I said, pretty rare. So that's basically notices. So the next part I want to talk about is issues during the meeting. And the big one here is when this council may close the meeting. Now, the Open and Public Meetings Act makes it very clear that these are the exceptions and not the rules. And so unless this council has one of the authorized reasons to close a meeting, then you can't close the meeting. And one thing to remember that's also important is, at least with this council, there's no such thing as being required to go into closed session. Closed session for this council is always optional. So the question is, do we have to go into closed session? The question is, should we go into closed session? And again, like I said, in the years I've been here, that's relatively rare. I know we've done it a few times, and I'm going to explain the reasons why we would go into closed session. And I'm not going to highlight everything, like all the authorized reasons for a public voting closed session, but I'm going to highlight two that are relevant to this council. The first one is discussing an individual's character, professional competence, or physical or mental health. That is relevant to this council, since this council sanctions peace officers, and those issues frequently come up. The other one I'll point to is investigative proceedings regarding allegations of criminal misconduct. Those are the two that are going to most likely apply to this committee. How it is done is a council member makes a motion. We need 2/3 vote to go into closed session, and we have to specifically state the reason why we are going into closed session. So the motion will be like, you know, I motion to go into closed session to discuss this person's, you know, character, professional competence, you know, something like that. And a couple of things to keep in mind while we're in closed session. The council can't discuss another topic besides the specific topic for which the closed meeting is permitted. So if you go into closed session to discuss a particular sanction for an officer, it needs to be just about that officer and just those issues with either, you know, character, competence, mental health, things like that. And that's one thing I've kind of noticed with entities is it's not intentional, but a lot of times there's a little bit of creep into kind of talking about other issues while you're in closed session. Let's not do that. The other important thing to remember about closed session is the closed session part is more for the deliberations part. The fact gathering is still done in open session, so you still hear the facts that Post presents, and the vote is also done in open session. So it's just the deliberation part that's going to be in closed session. So I think about covers it with that. The last thing I want to talk about is basically the stuff happens after the meeting. And this is really gets to the council's minutes and the recordings. So the state law requires us that the entire meeting must be recorded in written minutes made of the meeting that include just kind of, you know, some basic stuff, you know, date, time, place of the meetings, name of council members who were present or absent, how those council members voted on each of the issues on the agenda, all matters proposed, discussed, or decided. So basically information like that. Minutes and recordings are considered public documents, so anybody can make a records request to post to obtain the minutes and recordings of the minute of post council's meetings. The one exception is the minutes and recordings from when the post council is in closed session. Those are classified as protected, which basically means in order to get access, somebody will essentially need a court order to get those. Now keep in mind, we still take minutes and a recording of closed session with one exception. If the council does go into closed session to discuss an individual's character, professional competence, or health, then we do not have to keep a recording or minutes. However, the chair does need to sign an affidavit saying there are no minutes or recording from this portion of the meeting that we were in closed session because we were discussing this. So requirements for posting the minutes, we're required to make it available to the public. Post does a really good job with this because you can actually go to their website and actually just click. You don't actually need to request the recordings from the minutes because they're just on the website. You just go on there and just click and you can access those directly. But the law states we have 30 days to post for pending minutes. Once post council approves those minutes, that becomes the official record of the meeting, and post has 3 days to make those available to the public. And then with audio recordings, the same time limit, 3 days to post the audio recordings. The significance is this. If there are violations of the Open and Public Meeting Act, the significance is a court can void any action we take. Sometimes a violation can be cured in a subsequent meeting. But the other thing, too, is a violation of the law, if somebody does sue for an open and public meetings violation and prevails, that entity is on the hook for attorney's fees. And also, a member of a public body who knowingly or intentionally violates the Open and Public Meetings Act is guilty of a Class B misdemeanor. So those are kind of the consequences why we want to, you know, why we want to stay away from violations. But also, again, going back, but the more important reason is kind of the whole point of having these meetings open to the public is so the public can see and is aware of how Post conducts its business. So if there's any questions.
Mr. Bolander. Just a matter of clarification. If there is a violation of Open Meetings Act, would that go to the district court or court of appeals?
It would go to district court. Somebody would basically file a lawsuit saying this committee or whatever file or council violated Open Public Meetings Act, and it would be litigate it. However, if someone does call us out, courts have recognized that an agency can try and go back and cure the defect. Like, let's say inadequate notice. We didn't give 24 hours notice. What the council could do is void its action from the last meeting and then give proper notice and then rehear the issue. That's like a way you could potentially cure it.
Okay, thank you.
Yes?
Closed meetings. Discussing an individual's character, professional competence, or physical mental health. And then the other one is investigative proceedings regarding allegations of criminal misconduct. Isn't that what this body does?
Precisely.
Then why is this not a closed meeting?
Well, a couple of issues. First of all, this post-council is doing more than just the sanctioning of peace officers. The post-council, the function of the post-council is to provide advice to post about things like the academy curriculum and things like that. There isn't such thing as an entirely closed meeting. Like all meetings have to be open to the public. I mean, the public body closing the meeting may, for the majority of the time, have the meeting closed, but it always opens and ends open to the public. And again, I think part of the issue, too, is if the council wishes to deliberate in private about, and in, regarding those issues you just mentioned, it's certainly within the board's, it is certainly within this council's right to close the meeting. But again, the vote has to be, and the law is clear on this, the vote on the actual sanction has to be in public.
I have a follow-up on that. I know Director Stevenson, during his overview of the investigative process, indicated for due process reasons, this council is only given these documents, which is the notice of agency action, including the waiver or the order of default. I was reviewing minutes from a meeting, and I forget which date it was, but I think that it's been brought before this council before a concern about why the council members aren't given the full investigative files or reasons that we don't, that the investigators don't, and I think the director touched on that. So I think that if I'm understanding this correctly, these are overviews for any public meeting. But with this particular council, because of the due process concerns and everything like that, we're not a fact-finding body. So the investigative proceedings regarding allegations are included in the public document already, and we're kind of limited to these.
Yes, the documents that are provided to you, the council members to review, those are, we would consider, how we treated those in the past when people have made records requests for those. Those are what we've typically will provide to anyone making a records request. The investigative files themselves, our position is, and again, Grandma requires us to look at each individual record. We just can't rely on like a general classification. But in the past, typically we have denied access. We've considered the investigative files non-public. Those, and Director Stevens has talked about that, the kind of the reasons that we don't get, the tricky thing about this council is, you're right, it's not a fact finding. We've kind of bifurcated the process. The investigative process and the fact-finding, which is the ALJ, which is the evidentiary hearing the ALJ does, or alternatively, they can just do a hearing waiver, that's done. So this council doesn't get into the facts. So Post provides what those facts are to give, you know, the council an idea of how they...
Really, this council does not engage in investigative proceedings regarding allegations of misconduct. That's the investigators, and what is presented to us are
the findings from an investigative proceeding.
The findings, but I guess I'm having a hard time understanding about when we would close the meeting to engage in a discussion about investigative proceedings, since we're limited to what we're given in this.
Yeah, and I think where you're getting at is, what would you define investigate? Would you define like a discussion investigating proceeding? Like, you're not directly looking at the investigative files, but the whole sanctioning comes from an investigation. So it's kind of, and the laws, you know, it's not really clear on what exactly they mean by investigative proceedings regarding allegations of criminal misconduct. Obviously, the officers coming before this board are accused of criminal misconduct. And so I guess it's kind of a degree of how comfortable. I don't think we've ever closed a meeting for this particular provision. I think the times we've closed have always been for the discussing a character's character, professional competence, or health.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
To answer to Victoria's question, we actually did close a session. It's been about a year ago. We had a case that had not been adjudicated yet, and went into executive session because it was the council's position that we felt that if that information came forward, it could affect the adjudication process.
Oh, yes,
process.
I remember that now, yes. Okay.
So that, the due process, right. So that would be an example of a time that we would go into executive session.
And during that executive session, would it open up any more? Were the investigators more involved in outlining more than what was provided in the notice of agency action?
If I recall correctly, we actually put it on hold until that could be adjudicated and then brought it back to post-council for action. So that information could not potentially become part of a public record.
All right, anything else?
Just additionally, that had elements of HEPA issues and all kinds of other things because there was treatment going on and those type of things as well. With that, unless there's any further discussion, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move forward to disciplinary case summary.
by Marcus Yockey. Mr. Yockey.
Good morning, council members. So we have seven matters to be heard today. I'm just going to go ahead and jump right in them if there's no concerns. The first matter before the council is the certification of William Drew Judd. He was not employed at the time of the offense. The sustained allegation was a third-degree felony theft, which falls under Category A of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is revocation, and that falls within the baseline of the guidelines. A summary of the facts are as follows. On February 7, 2015, William Drew Judd was investigated for theft of two generators. During an interview with a criminal investigator, Judd admitted to taking the two generators, believing they belonged to both. They both belonged to his employer, because his employer owed him over $1,000 in back pay. Judd claimed he was going to use the generators as collateral for the back pay. And on February 19, 2015, charges were filed on Judd for theft, a third-degree felony, and burglary, a third-degree felony. On May 7, 2015, Judd pled guilty to theft, a third-degree felony, and the burglary charge was dismissed with prejudice. Judd failed to respond to the notice of agency action, and on May 24, 2016, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge and mailed to Judd.
Entertain a motion. Mr. Judd's legal counsel here? Seeing none, I will entertain a motion.
I move we accept the recommendation.
I'll second that.
Second, first by Dr. Budd, second by Kim Hawks. Vote, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Now move to the next one.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Jody Coles, a formerly employed with the Utah Department of Corrections. Sustained allegation is carrying a concealed loaded weapon, which falls under Category B of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a three-year suspension, which falls within the baseline of the disciplinary guideline. Summary of the facts are as follows. On October 11, 2015, Jody Coles went to the parking lot of a local business to confront his wife about marital issues. Coles concealed his personal handgun, fully loaded, in his pant pocket when he went to talk to his wife. Coles was a correctional officer and did not have peace officer authority while off duty. Coles also did not have a concealed carry permit and was not authorized by his agency to carry a firearm off duty. Coles did not display or threaten to use his handgun. Jody Coles failed to respond to the notice of agency action, and on May 24, 2016, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge and mailed to Jody Coles.
As a matter of reminder, anybody that may have a conflict, you will need to recuse yourself on this. Is Mr. Coles here or is counsel? Seeing none, do I have a motion?
I need to recuse myself.
Let me note it. Do I have a motion to accept?
Move we accept its recommendation.
A motion by Spencer Austin and a second by Sheriff Decker. Vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
The next matter before the council is a certification of Corey S. Madsen. He was formerly employed with the Salina Police Department. The sustained allegation is lying under Garrity, which falls under Category A of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is revocation, which falls in line with the baseline of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Summary of the facts are as follows. On or about July 7, 2015, Corey Madsen was investigated by his agency for allegations of officer misconduct and inappropriate sexual relations with a city employee. The internal administrative investigation revealed a Facebook account with a fictitious name that was created and controlled by Madsen for the purpose of communicating with the city employee. On August 3, 2015, during a Garrity interview, Madsen was asked if he was familiar with the fictitious name assigned to the Facebook account, and he replied no. He was then asked if he had ever had control over a Facebook profile or Facebook Messenger account assigned to someone by that fictitious name. Mattson said no again. Mattson was re-interviewed the next day by his agency regarding the statements he made in the previous Garrity interview. After being presented with evidence confirming the statements were false, Mattson said he understood why he was being terminated. In the post-Garrity interview, Mattson admitted to lying under Garrity. On May 18, 2016, Corey Mattson waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Is Mr. Mattson or his counsel present? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Go ahead.
On this particular case here, since there were no criminal charges filed, so this was an internal policy violation?
The investigation originally started as inappropriate sexual relations with a city employee, which would be a policy violation, and he was questioned regarding that under Garrity.
Thank you. Any further questions? Entertain a motion.
Move to approve the recommendation.
Second. Mr. Molesky is first. Go ahead, second.
Second.
Bruce Bailey is the second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
The next matter before the council is the certification of Stephen Sturette. He was not employed at the time of the offense. The sustained allegation is use of a controlled substance without a prescription. This falls under Category B of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 1.5-year suspension. This is a deviation down from the baseline, which is 3 years, and this is based on the one-time use for based on the facts that the drugs were used for a one-time legitimate medical purpose. Summary of the facts are as follows. On or about June 1st, 2015, Stephen Sturette, an unemployed certified peace officer who was serving a suspension from the council, used his wife's prescription hydrocodone to alleviate his back pain. Post was made aware of this information when Sturette submitted an application to reactivate his certification. During the investigation, Sturette provided a letter from his doctor. The doctor confirmed that Sturette was being treated for his back pain and was prescribed hydrocodone in the past. On May 23, 2016, Stephen Sturette waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Is Mr. Sturette present? Do you have any legal counsel, please?
Good morning, Post Council. Thank you for the opportunity to stand before you and to address this situation in this case. As you heard, I was just coming off of a 2-year suspension back in March of 2014. I don't know if I need to say what the offense was or not, but. I just want to publicly acknowledge and take responsibility for that. I went 2 years. I was probably one of the largest, biggest mistakes of my life. And I'm happy to say that I took that time. I made the corrections that I needed to put my life in order. And during that time, when the mistake was made, was going through a divorce and just kind of a low time. And the mistake was made. He was very out of character for me. But I have gone through a transformation, both emotionally and spiritually, and I felt good about trying to reestablish my career in law enforcement and corrections. I guess unaware, as I was reapplying, I put in there that I had taken medication for my wife, which was not my prescription. Realizing that it probably was a violation, but not to the extent that it's caused for me. I believe, you know, that laws are important. I believe in law. I'm hoping at this time to know that law is also, there's mercy and that there should be some leniency. And I guess it's my hope and desire today to come before the council requesting that you can consider the circumstance, and that maybe there's some leniency to a reduction. I've been an officer for 14 years with the Sheriff's Office in Weber County, nine of which I was a sergeant. I've always been a good officer. I've never had even a write-up. And I just feel that I still have a lot to contribute and offer, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to be able to work in this field again. Anyway, I appreciate your consideration of this matter. Thanks.
Any questions for Mr. Sturrett?
Please. Sure, not necessarily for Mr. Sturrett, but this is some discussion. This is one of the things we discussed in the previous post council and in the work group that we had on the weekend. I called it the weekend warrior. Gets hurt, takes a pill because he's dying on it. I believe that was on a weekend. So moving from that, the sanctions from the council, Mr. Director, are they activate from the time of the offense or from the time he applied to reactivate his post certification?
That is up to the council. Typically, it's from the date of separation from employment.
So that would have been 2014?
So far. For someone who's unemployed, it's been the council date generally.
Council date?
For their unemployed, it's from the date of the council.
I stand corrected.
The date of the council date.
So there's if I can clarify just really quick, there's a few different, it all depends on the council, and we've done this in the past. It's either from the date post becomes aware of it, the date of the post council, or date of separation. And there is some clarification in regards to that in the post disciplinary guidelines, I believe on page 2, just underneath the, oh, is it not there anymore? Okay. Maybe that's my copy. Other side. Okay, so it's on notes under one is what our notes are in regards to disciplinary action. And just for a clarification point, post did deviate from the baseline standard, which was 3 years suspension down to 1.5 years based on the fact that it was the one-time use and for a legitimate medical purpose. So,
and additionally, his doctor, is that correct?
And his doctor did provide a note providing that he had been prescribed hydrocodone in the past and would be prescribed in the future.
Victoria?
Just picking up on Mayor Molesky's comments about the weekend warrior, I think what I note from this timeline is that this incident, it appears to be a one-time use. It was something that probably would have been prescribed if he had gotten himself to a doctor anyway. However, he is in the middle of a prior suspension. He is right in the middle of his prior two-year suspension when this conduct takes place. I believe he was also freshly off of court probation by a matter of weeks at the time this took place. And with the guilty plea, I think that those are aggravating factors. He's on notice. He's on notice for a DUI and substance abuse related offense. And during the middle of that suspension, we have another incident. I think that those are aggravating factors. However, I still note that it does appear to be a one-time thing, and he was honest, and that probably, but not for his self-reporting, this would have gone unnoticed. I think that the deviation, looking at the table, is down. It's down significantly by 50% from that, and I think that if the council feels that from the date of report, so I think that would have been the date he applied to reactivate, which was March 29th, 2016. If we use that for a gauge, I think I would even be okay with maybe something closer to a year from that date. But I do think there are some aggravating factors at play here. It was one-time use, it would have been prescribed, but in the middle of a prior certification for also a substance abuse-related issue. And so I think I would ask.
And just for a quick clarification, the Post became aware of this use after the suspension had been served. So he divulged the information. So in regards to that, just Post became aware he was reactivating his certification following his suspension.
But the conduct, the taking of the pill, was during while he was suspended, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Chairman, I appreciate the comment, but and I appreciate the information in relation to that. I was before hearing that, I was actually would entertain a letter of caution because he's paid his price and he did self-report. But based on that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested in making the motion if you'd entertain one.
Go ahead.
I'd like to make a motion. We recommend a 3-month suspension starting from the March 29th date for Mr. Sterrett.
Have a second.
I'll second.
A second vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed?
Aye.
Nay.
Aye.
Group show of hands, please.
Is this for the nay? Is this for clarification?
Nays.
And those in favor?
And those in favor?
Favor. Passes.
So it's just confirming it is a letter of caution. Is that correct?
No,
it's 3 months suspension.
3 months from March
29th. March. Okay.
Based on the aggravating circumstances.
Based on the aggravating circumstances.
Correct. Now we'll now move to our next one.
Mr. Van Wagner, is your counsel present or are you present? Okay, go ahead.
No problem. The next matter before the council is the certification of Michael Leroy Van Wagner. He is currently employed with the Emory County Sheriff's Office. Sustained allegation is criminal trespass, entry on a private land while hunting. This falls under Category E of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 6-month suspension, and that falls within the baseline. Summary of the facts are as follows. On September 22nd and 23rd of 2015, Michael Van Wagner entered private property without permission from the owner of the property while hunting. Van Wagner remained on the private property to track a wounded elk previously shot on public land by a member of his group, hunting group. Van Wagner admitted to knowing the property was private land and said he made no attempt to contact the landowner for permission to be on the property. On February 3, 2016, Van Wagner entered a plea of guilty to be held in abeyance to the charge of criminal trespass under Utah Code Annotated 766-206, a Class B misdemeanor. On April 19, 2016, Michael Van Wagner waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the Notice of Agency Action. Just quickly before we have Mr. Van Wagner or his counsel up here, there is a letter from his chief, if you could quickly review that.
Sheriff Funk has a letter, if you'll refer to that letter.
Chair, if I could say something.
Please.
I've underlined an accusation that Sheriff Funk had made against the post staff and that he did not contact him. I have spoken with Sheriff Funk since we received this letter. I told him what I was going to say to the council in rebuttal to this accusation. We've contacted him. Investigator Moore has contacted him specifically on four
on two times, but in April we contacted him and let him know what we were thinking of. I think there was a misunderstanding that Sheriff Funk felt like his input would have some influence on the sanction or recommendation. And I told him that has never been the case since I've been here. But that's what he was anticipating and felt like he did not receive contact to solicit his input into what the recommendation should be before this body. But we have contact, and we contacted this captain two times. So there has been ample contact with the sheriff and with his staff. Thank you, Director.
Mr. Director, would you feel that maybe the sheriff didn't, in relation to the calls, not receive calls was during the post-investigation, not after it was completed? Or was he called during the investigation?
He was called during the investigation.
Any further discussion? Sheriff.
Can I ask a question? Was there any criminal intent with this case whatsoever that you could find?
If you could...
criminal behavior whatsoever.
And what do you mean? I apologize.
Criminal intent.
The only thing I've seen in there.
So we actually have a conviction that was held in abeyance.
A criminal conviction?
A criminal conviction for criminal trespass under 766-206. A Class G misdemeanor. So...
any further questions?
Has the council had an opportunity to review the letter? If they have, that is correct.
Can we have a moment to review?
Problem.
Everyone had an opportunity to review the letter.
Go ahead. And just for one more clarification point, to Sheriff Noel's comment, Mr. Van Wagner did know that the property was private and knew that he needed to make contact, and we also have the conviction on top of that.
Well, and as a follow-up on that, the statute requires that knowledge that the person's entry or presence is unlawful. He's stipulated to such facts. It's part of what is required. That's reflected in a conviction. I understand it is a plea in abeyance, but I think that there is criminal intent, and I think that that's bolstered by the fact that the ATVs were hidden at the time of the incident. That's indicative to me that he knew that this was inappropriate, and he took measures to prevent his activity being discovered.
If we could have Mr. Van Wagner or his counsel, I don't know if he's been given an opportunity.
One more question from Sheriff Noel.
It's not a question, it's a comment. I'd have to disagree. I don't think if this would have happened and this elk would have dropped right where it was at, we would never be here today. This was a person that was hunting. He tried to do the right thing. I don't think there was any intent here whatsoever. I've discussed this thoroughly with his sheriff. This was one of the cases that was brought up to our sheriff's association meeting. I'm going to make a recommendation if I can do that.
You do need to hear from the opposing side.
Director.
If I could just say something and reiterate what I presented in training. Pled guilty. So I'm compelled to bring it before the council.
I understand that.
Whether we agree there's criminal intent or not, the fact is there was a guilty plea received, and it's therefore presented to you.
And Sheriff Noel, What is your view of the facts that he admits that he knew the property was private, and that he admits he admits into hiding the ATV to avoid detection, to avoid being caught. What role does that play into the position that you've taken on this, if any?
Exactly where we're at right now today. I honestly believe that if he would have been understood that he could have gone to the property owner without getting punished for doing that, I don't think he would. I think he would have been able to do that. But he's a law enforcement officer. One of his friends shot an elk. What's he going to do? Let the elk go up on somebody's property and just rot?
I understand that, but I feel that the position fell. I don't understand, and I'm trying to reconcile how we discredit the fact that he admits in a Garrity interview, I know the property's private. No, I didn't make attempts to contact the owner. I know that the code requires me to give permission to do so. I know I also hid my ATV to avoid detection. And I'm not, and I think that I'm, to premise this, I think that I'm a little bit inclined to go under the recommended amount of discipline, but I think that and you're absolutely right, had the elk just died and fell down, we wouldn't have been in this position, but we were given a different set of facts, and then we have admissions that he knows the law, that he knows what he's doing is wrong, that he understands what he has to do, and that he takes measures to conceal his actions because he knows they're illegal. So I just am wondering how we can reconcile that with this innocent, this thing that I'm getting the impression that it feels like it's essentially a non-issue based on the letter and the kind of comments that have been made. I don't know what to do with that.
Mr. Boland would also like to comment.
I just want to put something out there that might help this council a little bit. As far as it's presented right now, it seems like the peace officer has admitted to engaging in conduct, which is a state offense. The question for this council is, after we let Post finish presenting the facts and give the officer a chance to address the council, the question is, are there mitigating circumstances that convince you to reduce the post-recommended sanction or increase it? That's at this point, that's what the debate about is, what is the right sanction? I mean, the conduct part is not up for debate. That's been adjudicated already. The only thing is, what sanction, if any, does this council feel comfortable?
Let's go ahead and have Mr. Oh, we have one more question.
So the letter from Sheriff Buck seems to be completely opposite of the facts presented in our case. I'm just wondering if there was any follow-up based on the information that was submitted.
There has been no follow-up based on the information provided by the sheriff, no.
Ms. Moran, did you have specific?
So specifically, it says after the private property owner heard the facts of the case, he was given permission to enter the private property, and the owner didn't suffer any financial loss, anything like that. It's in addition to what we have in the original submission.
If I could, I was going to wait till we got to the motion piece, but we're not getting there, so I'm going to state this anyway. When I read the letter, it's obvious, since I'm one of those that takes things a little personal, that the sheriff took it pretty personal. I have a lot of respect for Sheriff Funk and Sheriff Noel and all the sheriffs in our state. They do an incredible job. But I got to go back to where we're at here. I think that the system works. What frustrates me with his letter is that it attacks this council. And I've also heard some complaints about the council and their job that we do here. Or maybe it's just the complaints about Post. But I think we do the right thing. We are a neutral, objective group that has to make a decision on this particular piece. And so when I read Sheriff Funk's, I had to highlight and take out all the stuff there that's personal attack. And it works. We provide this opportunity for the sheriffs. For me, I'm from the largest law enforcement and corrections organization in the state.
I'm not always perfectly happy, but we have the ability to submit a letter that allows us to give additional information that we can weigh. And I'm on the side of likely it is, to me, it is a letter of caution in my eyes. However, I'm right with Ms. McFarland. I call bullcrap on the fact that it didn't happen or it wasn't intended. And I've been hunting on the Wyoming border, and I've had people in my party who have shot a deer, and if deer ran across the Wyoming border, you cannot go across the Wyoming border to get that deer. If you do anything, you need to notify the Wyoming Fish and Game and let them know what's happened. You need to let them know that whoever owns that land up there, and they all know who owns the land up there, they all know each other, you can go to that person and tell them. But when I read that letter, I take it personal, and I try to take all that stuff out. And the bottom line is, we've got a situation. They received their opportunity. The sheriff spoke his mind. We need to let the officer speak, and then we make a decision based on that information instead of making this thing so complicated. It is what it is. It is what it is. And it's a great process, and I'm thankful for it, because even though sometimes it makes me mad. So there's my two cents.
Thanks, Director. Any other conversation before we have Mr. Van Wagner? Officer Van Wagner? Do you have counsel present today?
I'd like to thank all of you guys for allowing me to talk to you. As Mrs. McFarland said, that I did admit to everything. I've taken responsibility. I made huge mistakes. The reason we didn't contact the landowner, I didn't know who owned that land. I'm not from Grand County. And we tried to see if we had cell phone service. We didn't. The closest cell phone service was down off and above Moab, which we were a long ways away from. And we felt that getting the elk, which we thought would expire quicker, would be just to get in and get it out. The shot was at night, not dark, but close to dark. And that's why we went back in the next morning, hoping that it was there. Knowing what we know now, and as she pointed out, the letter saying that the landowner gave us permission, that was after the contact with the deputy there and already issued our citations. We wanted to apologize to the landowner and make any corrections to her land if she felt that we damaged it, which we did. We went back with some shovels and cleared our tracks out. Her main concern was that other hunters would see our tracks and follow suit with it. She gave us permission to go back in and search for the elk, but we had talked with a DWR officer, and he felt it best that we just let it go, since we tracked it for so long and that we hadn't been able to find it, and he felt that it was not a fatal shot and that we should leave the landowner alone, and that's where that permission came from. I know that it was a very stupid mistake on my part. It's not who I am. I've never been that person. I've always been the ethical, the law-following hunter. Why this time? I don't know. Just seeing that elk run off, thinking that it was seriously hurt, I just thought it would be the best to get in there and try to get it out. And knowing now what knowing then what we know now, the landowner was only two camps down, and it's just, we should have just left the mountain, called DWR, and got the right process. I'm also here to ask that the recommendation of 6 months be reduced. I love my job, and that makes it that much harder for me to admit that I've violated the law. And I love my sheriff's office. I love my sheriff. I was able to read that letter before he sent it, and I didn't. He asked me if I felt it was okay, and I didn't want to go against him, so I just said, yeah. I know he was very upset about what happened. I know he's disappointed in me. I'm also grateful for my captains, especially Captain Ecker. I know he's reached out to some of you on my behalf, as is Sheriff Funk, and I'm grateful for them, for their how much they care for me. I'm grateful for the sheriff's office, all my fellow deputies. They're wonderful people. They're a family. You, those in law enforcement know they're your brothers and sisters, and I know that if they could, they'd be here behind me right now. And the most important reason that I, about me wanting to keep my job and not have a suspension, is my wife. As the letter Sheriff Funk wrote, she has had serious medical conditions for the last 11 years since my son was born. She's had two kidney transplants. They don't know why she keeps losing kidneys until last year when I was in the post academy. We had a bad episode, and they called in some experts from around the country, and she was diagnosed with a rare blood disorder that affects like 1 out of 20 million people. And the medication that isn't even 100% effective on it, but it's the only thing they have, is she has to take it twice a month for the rest of her life, and it's $40,000 for every single time she takes it. And if I lose my job, I lose my insurance, and I'll probably lose my wife. And so that is why I'm here. I've been sanctioned by my sheriff's office, and it might not seem like a lot on paper, but we're going through a big turnover right now. We lost a lot of people lately to retirement, and my chance to advance to a sergeant or higher is pretty much non-existent now, because I'll be on probation while my plea in abeyance is in effect. Just because we're a small agency, people are my age or my time frame that I'm there, we'll move into those positions and I won't have a chance to promote. And that's my fault. The whole time, I've never blamed anyone else for this. I've never tried to go and fight it. I regret every moment that I did it. And I just hope for mercy from you guys, and I thank you again. I also thank Sergeant Moore. She's been extremely helpful in this whole process. Without her, she's calmed my nerves on more than one occasion, and I'm really grateful for her and Lieutenant Acosta, and I thank you guys.
Thanks for your honesty. Director Stevenson.
From a post-investigative perspective, it is refreshing to have Mr. Van Wagner be so honest. And that doesn't always occur, and Sergeant Moore told me that a couple of times during the investigation. Just very honest, so I thank you for your honesty.
Thank you, sir.
These are unfortunate events.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a motion. Any discussion? Sorry.
Would you like a discussion first and then a motion?
Or we? Let's have a discussion.
Discussion. And on my preface, this is the next time that Colonel Fuhrer asked me to sit in on his behalf, I'm going to tell him no. I have a lot of thoughts on this, and I want to express them. Hopefully, they're appropriate. This is very much something that should become part of this body. We have a property owner who is trying very hard to exercise their property rights. As law enforcement officers, we have the responsibility to uphold those rights, not to violate them. I'm weighing that with the fact that when you look at what the intent of this law really was, mostly is conducting hunting on private property. That's really what the law focused on, which is not what Mr. Van Wagner was doing. Mr. Van Wagner was trying to accomplish another ethical act, which is to retrieve a wounded animal. He made a obviously well-stated and obviously intentional mistake of not contacting the property owner to do that. So there is a violation, but I think there is a mitigation factor, the fact that he wasn't attempting to hunt on that private property, but he did violate that property owner's rights, which we are responsible for upholding. So hopefully that's a mitigating factor.
Sure. I'd just like to say this. I think, too, in this particular case, for example, probation, he can't promote. The sheriff indicates he's lost almost $1 an hour for a year. Will. 2,080 hours is a general hour work year, and so that makes it almost $2,100 that he's lost. That's a pretty good hit. That's a lot more than some of these others are getting that are more serious or less serious. I'm one of those that thinks he's probably paid the price just because of that. Those kinds of things. What we try to do in this, at least in my understanding, is keep it so that law enforcement is held to a higher standard, that we expect more from our peace officers, and we're trying to get that. And however we get that, whether it's done through the agency or done through post, we just need to do it. In this case, I think it's been done in the agency, and I think all that can be done in the agency, that's where it should be first. And I think it's been done. Just my opinion.
Any further discussion?
I work in a real rural area, not like Grand County, so we run into this quite a bit. Trespassing whale hunting is actually designed for somebody that actively pursues onto somebody else's property in pursuit of game or something like that with the intent to hunt on it, not the intent to go recover an animal. There's a mix here. You have trespassing whale hunting, you shoot an animal that runs on somebody's land, you get charged with trespassing whale hunting. Or you don't go after the animal, you can be charged with wanton destruction of wildlife. So it's a toss-up. So appreciate his honesty and everything. So I just put that out there. So.
Any additional conversation? Do we have a motion?
I'll make a motion that we reduce it to a letter of caution. And with the statement, how much we appreciate the post counsel and also the post investigators for all the work that they do, and that the system works, and that's exactly what it's about. His testimony, along with the letter from the sheriff and the actions taken by Sheriff Funk, are, to me, substantial. So I recommend we reduce it to a letter of caution.
A second.
A motion from Director Cook and a second from Sheriff Newell. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none.
Thank you guys very much.
We'll now hear Mr. Walton. You have
The next matter before the council is the certification of Sean Walton. He is formerly employed with the Layton City Police Department. Sustained allegation is unlawful sale, offer for sale, or furnishing alcohol to a minor, which falls under Category B of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a four-year suspension. This is a deviation up from the baseline from 3 years based on multiple sustained allegations. A summary of the facts are as follows. On October 13th, 2015, Sean Walton was investigated by his agency for the allegation of supplying alcohol to a minor. The investigation disclosed that on September 18th, 2014, Walton furnished alcohol for a party at his residence. An 18-year-old drank the alcohol that was available for the party and became intoxicated. On or about December 26, 2014, Walton and the same 18-year-old went on a vacation together to Nevada. Walton purchased alcohol, handed the 18-year-old the sack containing the alcohol, and the 18-year-old took the bottle out and drank from it. The 18-year-old consumed additional alcohol throughout the rest of the vacation in front of Walton, and on October 21st, 2015, Walton resigned from his agency prior to being interviewed by the department. On May 11th, 2016, Sean Walton waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Mr. Walton, is Mr. Walton or his counsel present?
Seeing none, do we have a motion?
Chairman, I move we approve the recommendation by post staff.
Okay. First by Mr. Lekowski and second by Chief Stratton.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Go ahead and move to our next.
The final matter before the post council is a certification of Lindsay M. Workman. She is currently employed with the Cache County Sheriff's Office. Sustained allegation is intoxication, which falls under Category F of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a letter of caution. This is a deviation down from the 3 months baseline, and this is based on the facts found in post-independent investigation. A summary of the facts are as follows. On February 22, 2014, Lindsay Workman, a correctional officer with the Cache County Sheriff's Office, was intoxicated in her home. Police arrived and found Workman asleep or passed out on her couch. The police officer woke Workman. She advised the officer she was okay, refused medical treatment, and no action was taken. On May 11, 2014, Workman was again investigated by a local police agency for being intoxicated in her home. Medical personnel and police responded and found Workman asleep or passed out on the couch. Workman was transported to a local hospital and kept overnight for observation. On June 27, 2014, the city prosecutor filed two charges of intoxication on Workman, one charge of intoxication for the incident on February 22, 2014, and one charge of intoxication for the incident on May 11, 2014. On August 12, 2014, Workman pled guilty to one charge of intoxication in relation to the May 11, 2014 incident. The other charge of intoxication was dismissed. Post determined through its independent investigation that the elements of the offense had not been completely satisfied. But we have brought this matter before the council as a result of the conviction. On May 26, 2016, Workman waived her right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Is Ms. Workman here or her counsel? Please. Go ahead.
My name is Lindsay Workman. I am currently employed through the Cache County Sheriff's Office, and I've been there for about 6 years. There's a couple things I want to point out to the council with this this case. And at the time of the incident, I had just gotten out of a pretty bitter divorce, and there was a lot of disagreement with custody. I live in Cache County, but most of my family lives here in Salt Lake, and at the time, I was caring for a sister that was involved in a near-fatal accident. Also, my ex-mother-in-law was in the hospital down here in Murray from brain aneurysm, so I was trying to find balance between work and family and life at the time. So I did struggle for a few months with alcohol, and I was very forthcoming with my department and the issues that I was going through. I was charged with one count, thank you, intoxication, and it was at the advice of my lawyer that I plead guilty. It was explained to me that the prosecution would not work with a plea in abeyance or any other way, that they would, if I didn't enter a guilty plea, then they would charge me with two. I went with the guilty plea because it was the advice of my lawyer that it would be the quickest option to get through the process and put it behind me. So I did admit guilt in court, and I satisfied the terms of the courts with community service and probation and program counseling, and I was successful in completing all of that. I did also do classes on my own behalf to just help me get through it. So that's kind of where I was at the time that this occurred, and it's been 2 years, and I'm still employed with my department, and I've worked really closely with the administration to stay employed and work through these things, but they've been really good to work with me, and I kept in touch with them through the whole process. So that's just kind of my piece, unless you have any questions for me. It's been difficult trying to come back from something like this and still be employed as a police officer. So,
any questions for Ms. Workman? Do we have a motion?
I just have a question. I'm just kind of curious on the intoxication charge when it seems like she was in her own home the entire time.
Is that where the discrepancy comes from?
Yes. So Post determined through its independent investigation that because she was in her own home, Post would not feel that it's a violation of law. Because there is a conviction, as stated by Director Stevenson in his presentation earlier, we are obligated to bring a matter before the council if there is a conviction. And a guilty plea is defined in our statute. It can include anything from a diversion agreement to an expunged matter to anything. So because we had this, we brought this forward to the Post Council, and the lowest deviation, as stated by Director Stevenson, we will never go outside the bounds. The lowest one we can go to is a letter of caution.
As a matter of clarification, she was not a danger to herself, her family, her children, anyone else, is that correct?
Based on post-investigation, we could not determine that she was an danger to herself or to anyone else.
Thank you.
As stated in the elements of the offense.
And did you have any part of your investigation say that she had reasonably disturbed other persons while this was ongoing?
That's the kicker. She did not unreasonably interfere with.
So it was a bad plea deal, is what you're saying.
I will not comment on that. And I refuse to comment. But
you can. You're the only one who can.
Post refrains from commenting on that.
Mr. Chairman, I make a motion that Post take no action on Ms. Workman's file.
Second. We have a first and a second. First by Mayor Molesky and second by Spencer Austin. We have Dr. Chekas, do you have additional comments?
So noted that your children, your two sons, were placed in the custody of DCFS. Is that correct? Okay. Was that just overnight, or was that?
Yes, it was for 2 days so that they could release them to family.
Did you attend a shelter hearing or anything of that sort?
I did. And the kids were placed back with me, so.
Post shelter hearing, right? Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
And just for a clarification, the children were actually with someone else at the time the second offense occurred. And then when the children returned home, because she was no longer present in her house, they were released to DCFS.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. Thank you.
Nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll go ahead and hear from Director Stevenson. He was going to talk a little bit prior to our next scheduling. He wanted to address Post Council.
This is not an agenda item, but I felt prompted to say some remarks about what has happened today. And I will agree with Sheriff Noel. It is an uncomfortable process. But people make decisions, and we have to hold them accountable. And you as a council, in my opinion, did a fantastic job. This is what the process is about. However uncomfortable it may be, it is right. And I appreciate the discussions. That's what this meeting is about. It's not to argue the facts. These are human beings that we're dealing with. And we have lives that to consider. Keep in mind that there has been a decision made. So I thank you for your professionalism. Also, I want to make myself available regarding the presentation that I I presented to the council, I can address the Sheriff's Association and maybe any concerns that they have about our process, as well as the chiefs, to educate them about how we make decisions, how we come up with recommendations, and present them to you. So that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Director. Appreciate Post and certainly under your direction, the staff and their hard work in all of these cases.
Thank you, sir.
With that, we'll go ahead and move forward for scheduling. I was going to ask Sheriff Decker, we were looking at scheduling during the Sheriff's Conference, which I believe is in September. If I'm not mistaken, the date of that would be September 21st. I would defer to you, Sheriff. And is that when you anticipate would be the at the end of that conference?
The roundtable is Wednesday. Okay.
What time would you foresee that, Director?
What's that?
What time would you foresee having that?
Usually 1300.
And Sheriff Decker, what was
that? Civilian time, 1 p.m.
Okay. Sheriff, do you have a location for that, where we'd hold that? Or I'm maybe going to ask Post if they have a... Okay, we'll receive notification. Dr. Bud, yeah, please.
Are we in down south or here?
That's in St. George, is that correct? So,
21st, 1300, and location to be determined.
Wonderful. Thank you, Director. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Have a second. Thanks.